spinach.
Is Tim Butler here? Do I see him?
Yeah.
There he is. Okay. The December 17th meeting of the Preparedness for Terrorism and Disasters Working Group. Gosh, we could have gotten a little shorter title, don't you think? We'll come to order. We have many things on the agenda today. So I understand that Alice has given everyone strict time restrictions, and we will try to keep to those, please, and we'll see if we can get through the entire agenda. First on, I think we will wait on the first item, which is the approval of the minutes, until we get a few more members here, and they have a chance to look at them. So we'll just start right out with St. Paul's Emergency Management Funding, and Chief Butler.
Senator Higgins, members of the committee, Tim Butler, the Fire Chief of St. Paul, and current Interim Emergency Management Director, I appreciate you inviting me back to testify again today. I talked and spoke about training and certification last week. Funding today, I'll be fairly brief. I'll stay within my time constraints. So
that's good.
Three primary funding sources for emergency management program in St. Paul. One, of course, is our general fund budget. One is the Emergency Management Performance Grant, EMPG, that we spoke of last Monday. And then the federal and state homeland security grant programs that we've been involved in. The general fund budget in St. Paul is pretty slim. It funds essentially the maintenance of our siren, community warning siren system, some basic office supplies and materials and staffing for one person. And as I mentioned last week, Army of One, that's kind of been our motto. Our budget is about $150,000 per year general fund. The staff should be five people full-time based on some Tridata studies, a corporation that we hired to do a consulting study of management practices in fire and EMS. They recommended a full-time staff of five. We had some steps in place to do that with the general fund, but LGA cuts and the tax revenue bill for 2007 had some serious impact on that. And I'd just like to touch on those. We had, in 2008, had a $17 million gap in the city to close. Over the last 5 years, we've lost about $108 million in LGA funding. And that had a direct impact on emergency management this year because they basically the staff they had provided in the general fund had to get cut back to, again, Army of One for next year. In EMPG, the Emergency Management Performance Grant, we talked about that briefly last week. That funds the core program of emergency management, the core processes like maintenance of an emergency operations center, maintenance of your emergency operation plan, maintenance of some of your siren activity, awareness campaigns for the public. That is a federal program that's managed by the state, and it's administered through the counties. Cities of the first class, like St. Paul and Minneapolis, used to be funded with EMPG, and that funding went away a few years ago, except for what we get through our counties. Just to give you an idea of that funding, and I'm going to name a few counties and jurisdictions, not to pick on them, but only because as a comparison to St. Paul. St. Paul gets about $5,000 a year for this program. It's supposed to cover your base cost or half of your base cost. So we're looking about $100,000 to be covered, and we get $5,000 from the county of Ramsey. Ramsey County gets 20 times that amount. They get about $100,000 a year for a jurisdiction about our size. Hennepin County gets about $300,000 a year, 60 to 100 times the funding St. Paul gets, and their population is about 4.5 times our size. So just for some comparisons of cities of the first class with some of the other jurisdictions out there. The President Bush has proposed to cut EMPG funding in 2000 out of the 2009 budget. So as far as homeland security grants for this for St. Paul from the feds and the state, we've been very lucky with our regional partners. We've participated in regional grant writing opportunities and taken advantage of those. St. Paul has captured about $10 million over the last 6 years in those programs. Right after 9/11, it was pretty much, here's your money, go do good things with it. Now it's very competitive, very selective. Those programs must fill a gap in your capabilities of readiness and preparedness, and they must be regional in nature. So we're working with the UASI group, the other groups I mentioned last week, to fund that. In St. Paul, we have used most of that money for emergency public safety equipment, training, and 800 megahertz equipment. We have not used it for staffing, as some jurisdictions have, and that's why we're still an Army of One. So I don't make all those decisions. But it's hard to see other jurisdictions doing so well with the resources they have and see us struggling to still build basic infrastructure using those funds. So I'd be happy to address any questions you have.
Thanks, Chief. Any questions? And you said you were going to be succinct. You were absolutely right. That's very good. Okay. Thank you very much.
Senator Higgins, member of the committee.
Ramsey County Emergency Management Funding next. Judson Freed.
And he's representing me. Yeah.
Okay. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Senator. First of all, I'd like to clear one very quick thing. While I do have the honor of being the Director of Emergency Management for the County of Ramsey, I was asked to come today to speak in my role as past president and current chair of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers and to discuss emergency management in general statewide and not just specifically for Ramsey County.
Okay, great.
However, if there are any questions about Ramsey County at the end of this, I'll be more than happy to address those. And assuming I don't chew up all of my time, I'll address them at the end of the other things. First of all, the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, or AMEM, represents over 400 emergency management professionals in the state. We represent all 87 counties and close to 200 other municipal or political subdivisions within the state of Minnesota. So we have a fairly wide base on which to draw, and we're not a metro area or outstate area. We're the entire state of Minnesota, and we try very hard to speak with one voice and represent all of emergency management in the state of Minnesota. Emergency management in the United States in general has a pretty long history, and that's kind of a frightening thought. Really, the first emergency management legislation passed by the federal government was in 1803, believe it or not, some aid to the state of New Hampshire and to some municipalities there. And it is a little frightening to realize that 204 years later, we as professionals have not done a good enough job explaining to you, the people who pay us and who ask us to do things, exactly what it is we do for a living, so that there's some understanding of what exactly emergency management is and why it's an important thing for the jurisdictions within the state of Minnesota. An emergency manager basically fills a managerial function in government, which is charged with creating a framework from which communities can reduce vulnerability to hazards and cope with disasters. Not necessarily prevent everything. I mean, we can't prevent tornadoes and never will be able to. But by working to mitigate the damage done by things such as tornadoes or floods, and by working with our other public safety professional partners to streamline and enhance the response capabilities, and more importantly, to coordinate those responses, we can do a better job protecting the lives of our citizens, their property, and the environment of our state. Our overall vision as emergency managers is to promote safer and less vulnerable communities. That's sort of the major thing. Now, an important concept when we're talking emergency management is to understand that in the world of public safety, an emergency is not when you call 911. That's a bad day for you. For us, it's what we're paid to do. It's business. Now, I spent 20 years as a paramedic. I worked part-time as a police officer. I was a volunteer firefighter, did all those things there. And what I want to stress when I'm talking about a professional emergency manager is simply this. A psychologist is a medical doctor, has an MD, went to medical school, did all those things. But I don't think you would want that medical doctor, psychologist, operating on your son's brain tumor. Even though they're all doctors, there are areas of profession. I am a public safety practitioner. So is a fire chief, so is a sheriff, so is a police chief, so is, believe it or not, a public works director, so is the director of public health. But I would not want my best police chief giving commands to my best firefighters, nor would I want my public works director telling the public health director how to do his or her job. In the same way, an emergency manager is a public safety professional whose job it is to look into each of those silos and to coordinate across those things. Silos are good, okay? We hear a lot about not having silos, you know, get out of our swim lanes and make sure we share everything. I'm sorry, but I want the very best police administrator possible to be the sheriff or to be the police chief. And I want the very best fire administrator possible. On the other hand, in the event of a large-scale emergency, something affecting the lives and property and well-being of larger numbers of people, which is what we consider to be an emergency, we want to make sure that all those activities are coordinated to the best of our ability. That's where emergency managers come in. As an example, in Minnesota, every county, by Chapter 12.25 to be exact, is required to have an emergency management director and one or more deputy directors. That's all it says. Now, first of all, there's no money behind that. So the counties are required to have these positions, but no way to fund it. So most counties did what comes naturally, which is they found a creative way to find the money, and they made it other duties as assigned. In Minnesota, 16 of the directors of emergency management are the elected sheriffs of the county. 11 are deputy sheriffs. 2 are 911 supervisors. 14 are veteran services officers. 10 others have titles such as environmental services director, director of human resources, land manager, and jail administrator. Now, this is no offense to those people who are all professionals in their job and probably extremely good at what they do, but I don't really want the land manager trying to figure out the best way to evacuate the city of St. Paul or the city of Marshall. I want someone who is a professional emergency manager whose job it is to manage the response to emergencies by all these other public issues. But that's not a requirement of the state law. There's just a law out there that says, do this, with no guidance behind it, and I think that's a problem. I'll also point out that the requirements for the smallest counties are identical to the requirements for the largest counties. So the city with the part-time, we have people who are 911 dispatchers who are county emergency management directors. You have to understand that. And in addition to all that other stuff, oh yeah, they've got to do all of these reams of paperwork that come from the federal government and comply with all of these requirements for the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act and for the CERCLA and for all these other acronym soup laws that somebody has to know what they mean, not just on paper, but what they mean to the citizens we're supposed to be protecting. Keeping that in mind is a major deal because, as I said, an emergency is an event which threatens to damage or harm large numbers or significant numbers of people, places, the environment. A disaster is one of those that gets to the point where it overwhelms local resources. By way of example, take a look at the southeast Minnesota floods. Now, I've been sitting in these meetings since the first one. I've been sitting in the back, kind of just lurking in the background, saying hello to the few people that I know here. And I've heard some criticism of some of the response, for instance, to the southeast Minnesota floods, and some very valid questions as to what could we have done differently. Well, I'll tell you that the Houston County Emergency Manager, who's very good, by the way, at the job and a friend, is dual-hatted as court security. That's his main job. The Fillmore County Emergency Manager is the Veteran Services Officer, main job. The Steele County Emergency Manager is the Fire Chief of the City of Owatonna. Now, which one are they supposed to do when the emergency affects Owatonna and the county? In Browns Valley, the Browns Valley Fund, the Traverse County Emergency Manager is dual-hatted as the Director of the Ambulance Services. And then we sit in a committee like this and ask, why didn't it work perfectly? It doesn't work because emergency management isn't something that you can pick up with 140 hours, no matter how good it is, of Homeland Security emergency management training. And yes, I believe that everyone whose job it is to be an emergency manager in state government, I heard that question asked, should they go through the certification process? Yes. Does that make them an emergency manager? No. It makes them someone who is aware of what is going on around them, someone with whom I can work. Because the emergency is not a state emergency. The emergency happens in my county. The emergency happens in the cities of my county. And I've been doing this for 21 years, and I am a professional, and it appalls me that my fellow professional emergency managers have done such a lousy job of coming to you and telling you what we do for a living. And it frightens me that it took until 2007 for you folks to demand that somebody come up here and start answering these questions. Although I also have to tell you, it really makes me happy that you've done so. Funding issues, which is what you really asked me to talk about, but I had to get my point in there to begin with. Very simple. The Emergency Management Performance Grant Program that Chief Butler just spoke about mandates that money that comes from the federal government through this grant goes to the counties, not to the cities, just to the counties. Then the counties, if possible, will pass some of that money on. It is supposed to fund 50% of our operating budgets to deal with all hazards. It is not Homeland Security money. We need to understand that. Homeland Security is a part of emergency management, but it's a small part. There's a lot else. While certainly we have a well-founded worry about what will happen when and if there's another terrorist attack on U.S. soil, and I certainly worry about that, I know for a fact that there will be a blizzard this year somewhere in Minnesota. I saw an ice storm just the other day that barely missed the state of Minnesota. Tornadoes, floods, these things will happen, and EMPJ pays for that. And if that money goes away, so does the emergency management program. Chief Butler mentioned the fact that my county passes through some money to his. We also provide him with a full-time staff member. It's not exactly funds, but it's a person, because we know that that county can't afford to hire that person. Right? Without grant funding, that person's gone too. The other funding that comes down to, it ends up in just competitive grants. Last year, we spent approximately 3 days a week. That's 3 8-hour plus days per week for 16 weeks doing nothing but grants. That's it. Oh, and by the way, there was also floods, there were tornadoes, there were other, but that takes second point, because without the money, hey, we can't do anything. So the lack of any funding from the state to the local jurisdictions is a major problem. The risk of losing the money from the federal government to the state of Minnesota is catastrophic. Emergency versus catastrophe. That's your example right there. I've also heard a couple of times this committee asked for, you know, whoever was testifying in the seat, are there any policies or procedures, something that you can do concrete? And on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers and our 400 members, I'd like to propose just a couple of things that would be concrete. First of all is to mandate appropriate staffing at the county level and also for the Division of Homeland Security Emergency Management of the State's Department of Public Safety. At the local level, the emergency manager should be dedicated to doing nothing but emergency management. It is certainly fine for a sheriff's deputy or someone like that to be tasked with that. I understand that we have to find the money somewhere and a body has to do it. My county has no way to create a new position right now because we have no money. So somebody has to do it. But that has to be their job. It can't be other duties as assigned. I'm sorry, but it's too hard. I certainly don't want my paramedic to have other duties as assigned. I want him to be a paramedic. The Division of Homeland Security, for whom I do not work and do not receive any kickbacks, is dreadfully understaffed and dreadfully overworked. And I know every state agency probably tells you the same thing, but honestly, I'm not concerned. I'm concerned about Homeland Security Emergency Management because they do things for me. That protects my citizens, and they're the people I'm worried about. So since it is all about me and my citizens, that would be part of that as well. In addition to mandating that there be a dedicated emergency manager and deputy in each county and hopefully having some funding for that, I would also urge you to consider making sure that Homeland Security Emergency Management Division has the staff on hand to help us out when we need them. Increased funding for the Emergency Management Performance Grant and maintenance thereof at the federal level, if the state of Minnesota would weigh in on that argument. Currently for the 2008 budget being debated today, due to the work of Representative Oberstar, the money was up to $300 million. This is huge, up from $200 million. That's a huge increase, slowly approaching that 50%. Right now, the 50% we're supposed to be receiving is overmatched by the locals by a tremendous amount. I receive about 30%, and nowhere near my 50% that I could use just to run my program. That's not for buying special toys or dump trucks or anything. That's just for running the program. Okay, but for the 2009 proposed budget from Homeland Security, the amount is zero. The program is removed. So 2008, $300 million. From here on in, nothing. That means that that 30% goes away, and that is my entire staff, because that 30% currently right now pays for salaries. Local disaster. Right now in Minnesota, what happens is unless we reach a certain threshold, about $6 million statewide, in my county it's another $1.7 million roughly. So if a tornado comes through in Ramsey County, Ramsey has to have $1.7 million and the state has to absorb about $6 million total for it to become a federal disaster. If it doesn't raise to that threshold, if it only hits one of my communities, for instance, and the most of that stuff is reimbursed by insurance, the community has to absorb that loss, and then we come to you at the end of session and beg you for a special allocation of funds, which is debated at the end of session, and whatever extra money is left over usually does come through, and we thank you for that. On the other hand, setting aside, as many other states are doing now, a disaster fund simply for that issue to hold us over so we don't have to wait till the end of a session to give these communities some of the support they need in the event of a major disaster would be very, very useful. And third and finally, what we would ask you to consider is sustained funding for some kind of public awareness program. This past year, using pandemic flu funding, Minnesota Department of Health put together a program it's called Code Ready. How many of you have visited Code Ready in the last day? How many of you know what Code Ready is? Okay, not everyone. That's kind of scary. Because the purpose of Code Ready is so that everyone will know where to go for the same information so that we are giving a consistent, constant message. Because we're trying to educate people. And the only way to educate those folks is by giving them a consistent and constant message. And right now there's no way of doing it because the funds that were used to prepare this did not contain any sustainment dollars. So there is no way to sustain this website. No person to edit it, no way to market it, no way to tell people, the rest of you who did not raise your hands here, that Minnesota has a site you can go to for information, and no way to keep that information up to date. So those are three concrete things that I believe that the state government could undertake, two of which would, yes, cost some money from the state, and one would simply be encourage the federal government to do its best for our citizens. And that's pretty much it. Again, if you have any questions on AMEM or on Ramsey County, I'll be happy to answer them. And I thank you very much for the time to speak on behalf of the counties of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Freed. Once again, you packed a whole lot of information in
a
short time. Good job. Questions from the committee?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you have your notes all in writing that we could copy and hand out to the members?
I will email them to Alice.
Email them?
I have them, but with extra handwritten notes on top.
Okay, that'd be great. Thank you. We do have a quorum. When people get a minute, would you please look at the minutes from the last meeting, and in one of the breaks we will adopt those minutes. They should be in your folder marked today's meeting. The next item is Rocco Forte from Minneapolis Emergency Management.
Madam Chair, Christy Rowagen, the Deputy Director of Emergency Management, would give the presentation.
Okay. Hi, Christy. I didn't even see you there. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm a little froggy and fighting a cold, so you'll just have to endure my squeaky voice for just a little bit. I'll keep it short and succinct as well. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Once again, my name is Christy Rollwagen, and I work for Director Forte. I actually worked for him in the fire department a couple of years ago, and just recently, as recent as June, came over to work on the civilian side of emergency preparedness. So I'm currently working in his office. Before my tenure, though, with a dedicated emergency management position in the city, I was dual-headed as well. And some of the responsibilities I had in the fire department were around emergency preparedness. And when Rocco was the chief, then we reported, our reporting structure was, he was ultimately responsible for Homeland Security emergency management in the city of Minneapolis, but he was also dual-headed. So some of the messaging you've heard here today is pretty common to what we're seeing in our city as well. And after St. Paul went through their tri-data study last year, we also looked at a push out of having a dedicated emergency management division within our city. And a city of our size as well as St. Paul's, we're right with Tim in saying that we should have dedicated emergency managers in our city as well. What I'm here to speak to you about today is what we've done in the city of Minneapolis to address our gaps that we identified. I know Rocco's been here to give you a presentation in the past couple weeks about our visit out to Mount Weather and experiencing a four-day session out there where we identified what our big Homeland Security and Emergency Management gaps were in our city. And what I'd like to tell you is how we address some of those gaps, as well as to share with you what some of these Homeland Security grants have funded in our city, and some of the success they brought us when the I-35W bridge collapsed in August. Most of the gap analysis that we do in our city comes through either our city's business plan or our city's emergency operations plan, which we have to update every 2 years. We also work on the Urban Area Security Initiative Plan. We participate in the update of the State Preparedness Report and the State Homeland Security Strategy. And through all of those documents, we have a pretty good picture of statewide where the gaps are, as well as in our region and then in our city. So it's kind of a like a V-shape, and it starts at the top with the state and works its way to the county and then to the city. And what we do then is we participate in a process where we have representation at the state and the county and at the local level in prioritizing those needs. And of course, just like Judd and just like Tim, we push really hard for Minneapolis's needs to be the most important. But what we did do is we looked at where our gaps were in 2002 when we came back from our experience at the Mount Weather course. And communications, our dispatch was antiquated. We were working off of 1970s technology. We did not have a collapse structure team in the state of Minnesota, nor in the city of Minneapolis. our hazardous materials and our bomb squads teams needed some work and some equipment and training. We needed to look at security of the city's water supply. We didn't have any real mechanism for ensuring that our water was safe beyond just routine sanitary processes. We did not have a pharmaceutical cache in our city or, I don't even think, in our state at that point in time. We had insufficient training in incident command and weapons of mass destruction. We did not have a continuity of government plan in the city of Minneapolis. We were lacking in personal protective gear for all of our first responders. And our city hall, which is a public building, did not have an adequate security system. So Rocco was a fire chief at the time. He went up to our elected officials and said, I need $65 million, and he was promptly shown the door. But all kidding aside, the city did start to make some investments on its own, with the biggest investment being in our 800 megahertz radio system. And as we got competitive and started to be awarded Homeland Security grants, the city continued to put matching funds as needed towards those grants. So what we looked at is we looked at all of the Homeland Security grants that were out there. Our state Homeland Security grant program, the Law Enforcement Terrorism Prevention Program, which has funded some of our bomb squad activities, our Urban Area Security Initiative grant program, the Metropolitan Medical Response System grant program, and our Fire Act grant program. If you go on to page two, then you can see how we started to fill in some of the gaps with this grant money. We put $20 million into our 800 megahertz radio system in the city of Minneapolis. And just this past year, we rated up in the top six cities on the National Report Card on Tactical Interoperable Communications. It came in, ran an exercise, tested our system, and it worked well. After our bridge collapse incident, I would say our system worked flawlessly. Our emergency dispatch system, we invested $5.2 million into a state-of-the-art computer-aided dispatch system that includes automatic vehicle locators and utilizes GPS technology. The night the bridge went down, we knew exactly where every one of our police trucks, our police rigs and our fire trucks were that night on scene, because we could look at a map and see where they were. We also put money into our structural collapse program. In the state of Minnesota, there was not a structural collapse team present, and the nearest team was about 24 to 48 hours out, and it was a federal team. So one of the state's gap analysis showed that we needed some type of either a heavy rescue team or a medium rescue team in our state. And we helped develop that program, with Minneapolis participating in the heavy rescue team and hosting the training site for our collapse rescue program. Our hazardous materials team for the fire department and our bomb squad and our city's police department also needed to be more up-to-date with their training, up-to-date with their personal protective equipment and their equipment. So we put a lot of money into that, about $8 million. And actually, this last go-around, when we revised our state strategy and our urban area strategy, they have risen to the top as one of the state's number one strengths, is the capacity we put in there. We looked at the security of the infrastructure for the city's water supply, put in computer monitoring equipment and security cameras, and we have a pretty robust and secure water supply in our city now, which also serves other communities. It's not just the city of Minneapolis. We now have a comprehensive planning process, distribution process, and stockpiling of our pharmaceutical caches for our first responders and our public. We work with local public health and the state health department in planning parameters through the Metropolitan Medical Response System grant program. We had insufficient training in incident command and weapons of mass destruction. That has become almost mandatory training for almost every city employee in the city of Minneapolis, and at least those that have a response role in our city. We are NIMS compliant, which is the National Incident Management System, and we continue to train our new employees as they come through the door on weapons of mass destruction and ICS. We now have a continuity of government plan in place, and I'll tell you what, it worked real well the night of the bridge collapse. There were only three elected officials in our emergency operations center: our mayor, our council president, and our council vice president. Our continuity of government plan includes a mechanism that if those three were unavailable that night to respond to our EOC for the bridge collapse, we could go then down the line and look at who would be the next logical person to come into our EOC and be empowered to make decisions on behalf of the city. We also have included planning for a pandemic influenza outbreak as part of our continuity of operations plan. We have the top line turnout gear and police equipment that our first responders could have. They have it now in our city. And our city hall, which is a public building, does have some security mechanisms put in place. We've just done another gap analysis on the heels of the I-35W bridge collapse. But I want you to understand that we've been working towards this next goal for about 8 or 9 years. It predates my time with the city of Minneapolis, and it's back when Rocco was the fire chief. Our biggest gap now in our city is that we do not have an adequate emergency operations center. The room that we were in the night the bridge went down, and then 20 days after that was about as the size of a broom closet, as our elected officials like to call it. One of the constraints that we've had with the Homeland Security grants is that they don't provide money for brick and mortar, and that's what we need. We need to put a hole in the ground and get a building up, and we need a bigger building than what we have in the basement of our city hall right now. We have a room in the basement of city hall. Though we did make that work the night of the bridge collapse, it did have its constraints, and it is embarrassing to have the governor standing out in the hallway when he's a decision maker that needs to be in the room, or to not have a workspace for our people who are public information officers, and they had to sit on the floor by the elevators that night. So what we are looking at is we have put in our CLIC process, which is our capital improvement process in the city. We have received some funding for that. We have already obtained $1.4 million from the Urban Area Grant Program for 2007, and that will go towards technology. And we are anticipating that we will be successful in 2008 and 2009 in the Urban Area Grant Program to secure some more funding for technology. Once again, you can't use that for brick and mortar. So what we're looking for is we're looking for an $8 million bonding request of the state to construct the facility that we want to construct up at our fire training facility. It'll be a dual-headed facility. It will be used as our primary fire training site. It's actually going to be on the grounds of our current fire training site. It will be used as kept in the ready position for an emergency operations center that we can stand up immediately. And it will also be used to house our regional assets that we have through our collapse rescue team, our bomb squad, and our hazardous materials team. We will also have room in there for our voluntary agencies to come in, the Red Cross, the Salvation Army. We'll have room for our partners from the county and the state to be there with us in an emergency. And we will also have an opportunity to have a dedicated space for emergency operations center should we need to bring that emergency operations center up at moment's notice. And I'd like to just conclude with echoing some of the sentiments that Chief Butler had to say, and that is that whenever there's a cut to local government aid, and Minneapolis has endured those cuts as well, that once you get rid of the meat on the bone, there's nothing left but bone. And what we found in Minneapolis is that most of our budgets in police and fire are for personnel. And there's not a lot of room to cut out of your budget except for in personnel. So when we experience an LGA cut in the city of Minneapolis, it affects our staffing levels for our police and fire departments. And the first thing that goes is their equipment budgets and their training budgets. And so what we've tried to do with the Homeland Security grants is to augment some of those cuts. We've looked at ways that we can be wise about how we purchase our equipment for our first responders and train and exercise with our first responders. And so a lot of the exercising training we've done in equipment purchases have been regional with our partners in the county and our partners in the city of St. Paul. But with that in mind, it's imperative that we continue to receive adequate LGA to continue to fund our police and firefighters on the street and giving them an adequate response to grow our emergency management program in the city of Minneapolis, and that working with having an adequate local government aid as well as adequate Homeland Security grants is what's going to allow us to continue to succeed. I can tell you, and I know Rocco has said this to the group before, if it weren't for the Homeland Security grant programs and the opportunities we've had over the last 5 years to grow as an emergency preparedness division in our city, to train our responders, to equip them, to be in the room with all these people that I see here who we see on a regular basis in developing relationships. Our incident at the bridge collapse site would not have been successful. I will open up for questions.
Okay, questions. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Next, Ann Finn is going to talk to us about funding outside the metro area.
Madam Chair, members, I do have a handout today. My name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and the League, as you most of you probably know, is a statewide association. We represent over 830 of Minnesota's 854 cities. We have cities as small as less than 10 in population all the way up to the city of Minneapolis. So you can imagine that creates a pretty diverse pool of needs when it comes to emergency management and other issues. Thank you. I want to mention a few items, highlighting first what's going well and what kinds of things we're talking about at the League, and then also move on to some efforts that we'll be undertaking during the next legislative session that we want to use this opportunity to brief you on. We've seen some recent very positive examples of what's working well in Minnesota. In fact, I just returned from a conference not that long ago in the city of New Orleans, and it was a National League of Cities conference, and almost everyone I talked to there went way out of their way to compliment the state and, in particular, local officials on the response to the collapse of the I-35W bridge. In addition to that, we saw what we think is a very strong response to the floods in southeastern Minnesota by local officials as well as state and federal levels of government. In addition to that, during the last legislative session, you all were willing to work with us on passing an exception to the open meeting law for a circumstance where there would be a flu pandemic. The language that was passed in 2007 amended the open meeting law, Chapter 13D, to allow city councils to conduct meetings in the event of a flu pandemic or other public emergency. And it would allow members to participate remotely in the event that a public gathering would be prohibited. Looking ahead, I am having passed out right now some policies that are hot off the press at the League of Cities. We did do our policy adoption late last month, and I wanted to highlight a few items. Some of them are policy changes, and some are funding requests. We are looking for authors, so if I can put in a shameless plug, if there's something here that grabs you and you'd like to drop a bill in for us, we'd be glad to work with you. The first one is the Emergency Management Assistance Compact. Currently, the state of Minnesota participates in the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, and it allows the state to provide assistance to other states during disasters. It specifies that when a state sends emergency assistance to another state, the responding state's employees are deemed to be agents of the requesting state for purposes of liability. So in other words, if we send state employees to Wisconsin or any other state for that matter, the state that's receiving the assistance ends up being liable for the workers' compensation and other liabilities if something goes wrong. Now, what we would like to have is a modification to that that would allow local governments and local employees who offer that kind of assistance out of state to receive the same kind of liability protections and immunities as are provided to state to the state and state employees under this Emergency Management Assistance Compact. So that's something we'll probably be introducing in 2007. It would essentially allow cities and counties to use their equipment and employees to respond to a situation outside of the state of Minnesota. The second document that you see deals with emergency communications, and I'm all but certain these issues are not unfamiliar to this committee. The policy acknowledges and appreciates the state investments that have been made in public safety communications infrastructure, but it also reflects a need for ongoing investments. We did have our regional meetings this past fall, and in a number of our greater Minnesota cities, we heard a lot of anxiety about the ability of those smaller departments and agencies to participate, particularly in the armor system. and folks are very nervous about how they're going to be able to fund the upgrades or make their systems compatible in order to fully participate in that system. So that's an area where we would like to maybe increase our efforts a little bit to make sure that all the folks who want to be able to participate in that system are able to do so. And then finally, we have a policy dealing with fire mutual aid, and that generally expresses a need for state statute to allow fire departments to respond in situations that are not quite at the level of declared emergencies. In other words, we heard, for example, from the city of Winona that they have a very, very highly trained hazardous materials response team, and they would like to be able to respond outside of their jurisdiction, but in order to do that, they may need some assistance through some tweaks to state law that would allow them to do that without incurring liability and with having that the other levels of government that are getting their response to help them to fund some of the training and responses that happen. And I guess just building off of that, and you won't see this in the policy, but I did talk with the executive director of the League's Insurance Trust this morning when I was preparing for this hearing, and he talked about what he called extraterritorial responses, and that is generally what happens, and we're seeing in a lot of cases with regional centers where there are larger departments that have better training, better equipment, more employees, and they are willing to respond outside of the jurisdiction. And this is beyond just the fire departments. It might be EMS, ambulance, fire, police, any of those folks. And they want to be able to do that without a formal mutual aid agreement. And we probably would need some statutory changes in order to accommodate that. And Madam Chair, that is all I have for you today.
Ms. Finn, why just the fire departments for the mutual aid on the third item? Why not police departments and public works and whoever else?
Madam Chair, members, I think the reason that our policy only addresses the fire issue is that the fire community came to the League and said that they had a specific need in this area. And in the time that has passed since we discussed that policy, we've heard from more folks, particularly from the EMS providers and in some cases law enforcement, who have told us that it would be helpful to have to expand that policy to include them. And it's something that we would definitely be willing to look at.
I think that definitely needs to be done. I think Chief Butler and I talked about this in the hall.
Certainly.
A little bit,
and Madam Chair, I think our insurance trust would be very excited about that too. We just sometimes don't talk to each other as well as we probably need to.
Good. Other questions? Senator Bonhoff.
Thanks, Chair Higgins. I was wondering with regard to the first policy statement, do we have an issue between our in our own state, between city and state? So if cities want to help each other, who's responsible for the liability? Were there any issues with that when the various county or cities helped in the bridge collapse?
Ms. Finn?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, I think we need to take a much closer look at that because we've had circumstances arise, particularly with the recent emergencies, that we were a little bit unclear about how to advise our cities when it came to responding. We had folks that, you know, called the League or called the cities where these emergencies were happening and wanted to provide equipment or assistance, but they didn't want to put their own taxpayers at risk for having to bear some liability. And so I guess the answer to your question is we probably need to take a closer look before I could say for certain.
Madam Chair, if I may, we learned as we went through the FEMA process that basically they go back and look at all the mutual aid agreements, and some agreements, quite frankly, were a handshake in the 1950s or 1960s, and those individual departments are not being refunded because of that. So I think it makes a lot of sense for us to look at this. The fire service has more mutual agreements than anybody else because we have been working under mutual aid for years. But quite frankly, it's usually the jurisdiction that's right next to you. We have not had the luxury of having mutual aid throughout the whole state that is seamless. And I really do believe we have to work in that direction.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add a comment to that. I think that in some cases, that you know, where it's on the scale of something that has happened like the flooding or the bridge collapse, I don't know that those units of government are so nervous about being compensated for the response. I mean, certainly that would be nice. But in many cases, they want to be able to go because they have the resources, they're willing to do it, the community's behind that response. But they're nervous about the liability. I mean, they could probably come up with the resources to do the response, but if something goes wrong and they end up liable for a workers' comp bill or a loss of equipment that where they have to replace something, that becomes pretty daunting, especially for a small department when they've been responding outside of the jurisdiction.
I can sure see that.
Yes, Madam Chair. And Ms. Finn, thank you for being here, speaking for cities. We've heard from a lot of other people who have been here that there has been a change in the last several years in terms of willingness to cooperate and partner, not only among cities, but between cities and counties, and also between different agencies, between police and fire. And that's been true in the metro area, and also we saw exhibits of that with the floods in southern Minnesota. Generally, what do you feel that climate is toward willingness to partner and collaborate in greater Minnesota between cities and counties and among cities? Have you seen improvement in that in the last 5 years? Ms. Finn.
Madam Chair, members, it seems like when we talk with folks in greater Minnesota, they're very willing to do it, and they understand that there has to be cooperation, especially given that, there's potential at any given time for a terrorist event or a disaster. And folks are talking out there. I mean, we've heard from people who sit down on a regular basis with their city and county officials and talk about take inventory of the equipment that's available. Or they do training exercises or mock events, and they are talking about those things. But I think when it comes right down to it, there's a lot of concern about what authority they have to actually implement some of the plans that they have.
So it might be helpful to do something legislatively to help that.
Madam Chair, yes.
Ms. Finn, a question. We had testimony last week from Assistant Chief Bostrom, I think, in St. Paul about potential mutual aid language changes in statute that they may be interested in seeing to help prepare for the Republican convention next summer. Did you develop, presumably St. Paul as part of this policy development, but have you specifically been in contact with the convention security planners?
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, as a matter of fact, we just had a phone call today from them, and they want to make sure that they're at least consulting with the League's Insurance Trust to talk about what that means in terms of sharing resources for that event. And I would anticipate we will be very thorough in reviewing how that will be done, and so we can maximize the safety for folks who want to participate in this event.
Thank you.
Anything else?
All right. Thank you very much. Before we go to the next state emergency management funding list of testifiers, can we look for a minute at last meeting's minutes? Did anybody see any corrections that needed to be made?
I move approval.
Okay. Is there a second? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. The minutes are adopted. Thank you very much. Okay. State emergency management funding is the next item. And we have many people coming to talk to us. Mr. Gustafson, is that
yes.
You? Okay. Go take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Brent Gustafson. I'm from the Minnesota Department of Finance. And I'm going to work from a set of handouts entitled Budget Context of Preparedness Spending. And I want to be fairly brief. so that you can hear from the agencies who are more directly involved with operating and paying for emergency preparedness activities. But I wanted to provide you a little bit of context of the overall state budget and where resources are directed in this manner. You've heard from local governments and some of the perspectives about where resources are tight or where resources are sought. I think one of the messages I want to convey is that from the standpoint of the state budget, this is not a big piece of the pie, and I think you'll see that as I go through that. But so I think just trying to understand that where you participate in this discussion has a bearing on how big a financial issue this is. And so I just want to set some context for that from the standpoint of the overall state budget. The bottom of the first page is the distribution of state spending out of the state's general fund. This is where much of the budget discussion and debate occurs. It's the state's biggest and most flexible pot of money. About 60% of the state's operating money is in the general fund, close to $35 billion for the current biennium, and you can see how it arrays. Most of that money goes to someone else. It is not part of state operations. Most of it goes to school districts or to provide health care services, goes to higher ed institutions, or 9% of it goes to local governments. And each of those entities makes choices about how they spend that money. But you can see where the bulk of the money in the state's general fund actually goes to someone else. The areas that you'll hear more about directly in areas of health and human services and public safety, from the standpoint of legislative appropriations bills, you can see that's the two of those combined are about a third of the state's general fund budget. And I'm going to go into a little more detail there, but you see those at the bottom of the slide on the first page. When you expand the view a little bit further on the second page and look at all state operating funds, it's closer to $56 billion for the two-year period. And this goes beyond the state's general fund to account for the money the federal government provides us, to account for money in special funds like the Trunk Highway Fund, the Healthcare Access Fund, the Environmental Fund. This is a more all-encompassing view of how the pie breaks out. And you can see again that the share of health and human services is larger because of federal money as it relates to healthcare. The public safety slice is a little bit smaller. Everything else gets a little bit smaller because there's so much federal money in healthcare. But you just see how the distribution is a little bit different here. But I want to touch on the slide on the bottom of the second page, which is you're going to hear a fairly descriptive understanding of what the health department does in this area. But you can see that the health department's a relatively modest slice of the health and human services pie because so much of this money is going to pay for healthcare services for individuals. So even within the scope of just that bill, the health department as a total is relatively small, and what Ms. Lighthizer will describe is an even subset of that. So as you see, from the standpoint of overall resources, the amounts of money that are in these activities are relatively small. And you just see there the general fund versus the total budget picture. The health department's a little bit bigger on the all funds picture because of the predominance of federal funding in their operations. Turning then to the other area where you'll hear a fairly detailed discussion about key activities and emergency preparedness at the Department of Public Safety. On the top of page 3, looking at the Public Safety Omnibus Appropriations Bill, you see the distribution between the general fund and then encompassing all operating funds. And here again, most of the resources are directed not toward emergency preparedness, but rather toward the incarceration supervision of offenders within the Department of Corrections or towards the judicial branch, the combination of the courts and the public defender making up, a third to 40%, depending on which pie you look at. The Department of Public Safety itself is no more than a fifth on an all-funds basis, and the all-funds, you're gonna pick up then the money in the public safety radio system, some of the federal money, the Homeland Security money is going to be on that all-funds chart that's not on the general fund side. Finally, I guess the points I want to convey is that much of what is described as emergency preparedness funding is in agency ongoing operations. The activities of the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Health, the Department of Transportation, others, are part of their ongoing operations. They've been part of infrastructure operations for a number of years. When you look backwards, the picture can look different than if you look forward, because much of the money that we as a state spend on emergencies can be in response to them after the fact. You think about the floods are a good example. No one budgeted for an August flood in southeast Minnesota. Instead, we paid for it after the fact. And so looking forward, some of those resources aren't there. They may be there before the biennium is over. Again, there have been, and you've heard some of the local governments talk about this, specific initiatives in recent years to address not ongoing operations, but rather some particular concerns, things like pandemic influenza, where we've had both in the most recently completed fiscal year as well as some budgeted resources for the current biennium directed towards pandemic preparedness, and a much larger dollar in statewide scope in terms of 800 megahertz public safety radio system, where hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent in the metro area to build the backbone or to provide the local government augmentations to that system. The now slated statewide expansion that you'll hear about from Mr. Wiggins, with phased increases in 911 fees to pay for revenue bonds to build out the rest of that backbone for the rest of the state, close to a $200 million endeavor over the course of that project. One other thing I guess I want to conclude with is that much of what we're talking about and how you cast that net in terms of definitions is in the eye of the beholder. And as a result, we don't, as a Department of Finance or from a statewide standpoint, have the ability to describe what is being spent across the state in preparedness activities. I think the agencies you have here today describe much of that, the predominance of it. There are any number of smaller activities within agencies, like even the Department of Finance, which many wouldn't consider part of emergency preparedness, but conversations occur in smaller staffing level agencies about continuation of operations. Those are commitments of time and effort that meet a preparedness definition in one sense, but it's not big money and it's not what many of you have been focused on. It's not where the focus needs to be, but just so you understand, the scope can be broad. We don't have a way to capture it all and define it and report it, but I think the agencies here will describe most of what is going on in state spending in these activities. And Madam Chair, with that, I'd be happy to answer questions or provide more detail.
Thanks, Mr. Gustafson. Questions? Senator Winfrey?
Madam Chair, Mr. Gustafson, as I understand your testimony, then there isn't really a single place to get an overview of state spending on emergency preparedness, terrorism, natural disasters, or any of those things. There's no place to sort of look at where our priorities are.
Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I think what I've tried to describe in terms of if you look at the pie charts that describe overall state spending, I think that's I've always believed that budgets are a reflection of priorities and that those are the priorities of the state as they're represented in budget choices. But there's not a way to encompass activities that in your mind or in my mind meet a definition of terrorism preparedness. And some of it's as simple as how you build a database and how you report information out. Is there's not an agreed upon definition. There's not an agreed upon set of codes that you know, we've got vast amounts of data. Turning it into that type of information is not a reportable set that we have at this time.
I have follow-up questions. Dr. Westrup.
No, go ahead.
Okay. But I guess, well, the question, I mean, if we look, as Mr. Gustafson, the pie charts do represent priorities in spending. And I understand that perhaps the state has not had in the past a priority of breaking this out as a separate set of budget items to look at. It seems to me that if you're dealing with something fairly core to public safety, that might be kind of a good idea to do. And I understand it doesn't fall into neat agency definitions very well because it goes across what people are doing. And I understand all the problems associated with that. Wouldn't it be a good idea if we're trying to make policy decisions about risks and potential threats and potential damage to try to have a single place where we can look at those resources together? I mean, just to make informed policy decisions?
Mr. Gustafson.
And I guess I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm not trying to put that as a challenge to you, but doesn't it seem like that's the kind of thing that we would want to have?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I certainly don't disagree. I think, you know, depending on where one sits, I think any number of ways to report information are helpful to policymaking, and I think this is among many good ideas of how you would array information to describe key functions of government. I don't, you know, data system availability or data system capabilities to report things evolve over time, and this may be a worthy manner in which to do things in the future. I guess I'm trying to say is at this point in time, there isn't a set of information like that. I don't disagree that that's a useful set of information.
And I guess then,
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The follow-up question would be, how do we assign priorities in that case if we don't know what the overall look is? And I guess, you know, as Representative of the Department of Finance, you might be not the person who's deciding what the preparedness priorities are, but as a representative of the administration, I don't understand how influenza and public safety radio are the ones that are picked out as the things that we should be specifically looking at as opposed to all the other kinds of investments and what threats those specifically help us address or not. So it just seems to me that it must be hard to make those kind of budgeting decisions and those kind of prioritizations without some kind of an overall finance view. So I hope that that's something that the administration looks at and maybe something we can do as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, just to be clear, I chose those examples just as recent and fairly visible targeted efforts, not that they are in any way more or less priorities to other investments, but just wanted to specify that those are recent examples where instead of ongoing infrastructure and spending for, say, the state health laboratory, these were more specific types of activities.
Yes, Madam Chair, this is really more of a comment, I think, following off of Mr. Erzman's presentation, is that part of the problem we have today is, as you've identified, Representative Winkler, is that we don't really have a place to put preparedness. But I would even argue it's more complicated than that. Preparedness activities of getting ready for something are one thing. We make the assumption part of preparedness is that if a bridge goes down, that the Minneapolis Fire Department, Police Department, and others will be there, and they'll respond immediately. That's considered part of preparedness. On the other hand, if you have a pandemic or a terrorism attack, the people who are going to be responding to that are nowhere today considered in the budget issue of preparedness because they're just part of the normal workforce. They're going to be going for weeks to months dealing with the issues. And so I think that one of the things is we have to also understand that a lot of our preparedness activities have been around that catastrophic, instantaneous event. It happens now. It's over with, and we're in recovery within minutes. Where there are going to be other events that will hit upon us, I can think of some that are intermediate, like forest fires, which may burn for weeks, but they're not going to last for months and months kinds of things. And we do have some events that we need to prepare for, such as terrorism and pandemics, which will last for months and months and potentially, and they're going to be different. So I think as we go through this, you can't even just be quite as simple as preparedness as a general category because they really are going to be different and they're going to talk about different kinds of activities once that the event happens and who will be considered part of the response group and what are they going to be doing.
That's right.
But Dr. Ostrom, wouldn't that be a sort of stage two? I mean, wouldn't we have to accomplish stage one of just having sort of a
information
to begin with?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I absolutely agree. But I think that, as Mr. Erzman just said, people don't often realize that government infrastructure by itself is one of the most key aspects of preparedness for everything. So we're sitting here today not talking about the Minnesota Department of Health Public Health Laboratory, yet it's going to be a very key asset. It's going to be just as important during a pandemic as were that crush building machinery that Rocco so appropriately got us in time as it was for the I-35 bridge. But it's easy to understand that's a preparedness tool that was purchased for that issue. It's harder to understand that the Minnesota Department of Public Health Laboratory is going to be just as important at that time. That's an everyday thing we just assume is there. And I'm just trying to point out that when we're really trying to be broad in understanding our response, if we don't have a lab infrastructure in place at that time, we're pretty much to hell in a handbasket. It's too late to think about going and buying it. Would have been too late to go think about buying those tools on the night the bridge collapsed. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking we have to even take a broader view of this and understand that one
crisis does not make for all crises, and that unfortunately it'd be nice if it did. It'd be sure a lot easier. But as I was just pointing out that, yes, you're right, we have to start there, but we can't stop where I think I heard is stopping. We have to look even farther to go down there. If we had a major introduction of a pathogen in or a disease-causing agent in some of our cattle in this country or in this state or our turkeys, we could have an economic disaster second to none relative to our agriculture. There's going to be a whole different set of responses there. They're going to be a crisis and emergency that aren't about red lights and sirens. And we have to just understand that each of those are going to require us to think about and clearly elucidate which are the tools, what are our preparedness, and how are we paid for them or not paid for them yet.
Senator Bonnoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Osterholm. I appreciate that we're here and we're doing that, and I appreciate your raising those things. Mr. Gustafson, I was wondering if you could give me some understanding of what the types of programs and services are that the federal government is funding that makes up for that big difference between the 1.7% that we spend out of the general fund, but then once we include what we're getting from the federal government, it goes up to 4.9%. I don't sit on the health care committee, so I'm not familiar with what exactly are we getting from the federal government.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonnoff, you're asking if I can clarify the health department change, the change in the size of the pie for the health department on the bottom of page two?
Yes, not specifically like where exactly is the money going, but just give me some general sense of the types of programs our federal government is putting into that pie.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonnoff, going on memory, and I can certainly follow up with a lot more detail, the federal government has a fairly broad array of public health grants that the state health department receives. Some of them are ongoing infrastructure for community public health. Some of them are competitive grants that, as I understand, the Minnesota Department of Health has been fairly effective competing for national grants. I think it is a quite broad array from disease surveillance, prevention activities, some of the ongoing testing and infrastructure or support of the agency is federally funded. There is it's pretty broad, and I'm not recalling a lot of it, but I could certainly get you that information.
Thank you.
Dr. Oster.
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator, just to get back to that point, I think that's a very key one, again, as we look at preparedness. One of the problems we have with federal funds, which has been their episodic nature, here today, gone tomorrow, and you can't maintain preparedness on that. In the last 24 hours, the president has just vetoed all the pandemic preparedness money for next year. We have none. So the health department's program, which was on track as of today, just basically hit a wall as of today because of what's happened in Washington. Now, maybe that'll be rectified. Some are less confident that it will be. And so one of the things I think the state ends up having to do then is serve as the buffer between the federal and the state. Obviously, we don't want to miss any federal opportunities, but if we think we're going to build preparedness based on federal opportunities, you better hope we don't have winter a couple of years in a row. You know, that's the kind of thing it's going to be, and I think that's an important message that we have to take because that's a habitual problem.
When we were putting our public safety budget division budget together this year, we actually had a fairly long list of all of the items that we got federal funding for and what we had had in previous years, what we had gotten for this budget year, and then what may or may not show up in the current round of budgets. And as we were putting the budget together, some of those pieces of funding came together, but at the end of the day, we had to go without some of it because we still didn't know. Let me also introduce Representative Jeremy Kalin, who has joined us at the table today. Feel free to jump in and ask questions. Welcome today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions for Mr. Gustafson? All right. Mr. Ayersman, Health and Human Services. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I promise this will be the briefest of all presentations today.
Thank you for the opportunity, first of all, to provide an overview of DHS's funding for emergency management and disaster prevention programs.
Mr. Erisman, I'm having a hard time hearing you. Can you pull the microphones a little closer to you?
Talker here.
Okay.
Is that better?
Pull them in close.
Better?
Better. Thank you.
Basically, the Department of Human Services, our role in emergency management and disaster prevention is very much a support role to larger coordinating agencies such as the Department of Public Safety. In fact, this is reflected in our funding stream. Our funding for these programs or activities consists large. It's relatively small, and it consists mostly of targeted one-time grants received from the Department of Public Safety. So we're kind of at the end of the funding stream, and we help to provide some support for these targeted with these targeted grants. Some examples for activities for which we have received targeted grants would be pandemic preparation, training relating to pandemic planning activities, equipment purchases related to pandemic planning. There was a one-time grant related to security, which was indirectly funded by Homeland Security. That went to provide communications or backup communication systems and security equipment for like state-operated services and so forth. So those are some examples of some of the one-time money we've received and how that's been applied. So one other activity that is funded through the Department of Public Safety again, and I believe they're going to be covering this within their presentation, their overview, their funding activities, is funding of our support role in planning and responding to a nuclear power plant emergency. Such planning and response preparation is required by statute and also by FEMA. This funding is typically approved biannually and is contingent on DHS's level by the Department of Public Safety, and is contingent on our level involvement in planning and response for a nuclear power plant emergency. So we keep yes on that. And that's pretty much about it. Like I said, I think you'll receive more information as for these funding streams as a part of the overview for DPS. So any questions?
Okay, thank you. Questions? My head is spinning with numbers. Ms. Lighthizer from the Department of Health. Years and years ago, Ms. Lighthizer and I went up to Chicago for some emergency preparedness disaster hearing. I can't think how long ago that was. Betty, she knew way more than I did.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm the Director of Emergency Preparedness for the Minnesota Department of Health. Oops. This should be easier. Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
It's a little cute on this, but that's
fine. I'm going to do a quick overview of funding issues and some activity issues for the Department of Health, talking particularly about federal funding, then pandemic influenza, and state funding. The Department of Health is involved in a variety of ways in response to disasters. These are a few of the disasters from this current year. And we are involved in prevention, investigation of the particular causes that might have contributed to an event. We may be making recommendations for intervention or treatment, and we'll be doing health risk assessments. I'm going to start with the healthcare system emergency preparedness funding. This is new funding for the department, and it supports activities of hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, other parts of the healthcare system. The money began in 2002 following the 9/11 events and the anthrax events of 2001. And since that time, we've received about $44 million in this area. This year, it's $8.1 million, which is a reduction from last year. However, then we also got a different grant of $1.3 million for pandemic influenza preparedness to purchase materials and supplies. That's one-time money. And then there was the additional activity and effort that the metropolitan area did, and they are being funded this year directly at $2.5 million from the same program area. And of that, money, about $4.5 million, is given out in grants to regions and other grants. We use a regional structure for healthcare system preparedness. There are 8 regions, and the colors represent the different regions. We are asking that the 140 hospitals in the state plan individually at their facility, but then also work together. And that has meant that they've had to overcome their usual approach of maybe being competitors and work collaboratively and come together and really work together. And all of them have entered into a compact with other hospitals in their region to develop plans. And I would say that that contributed greatly to the healthcare system rapid response to the bridge collapse and some of the other events that have happened this last year. Some of the other activities that the healthcare system is involved in is behavioral health. Most emergencies have a health impact, and many times it's a behavioral health component. Sometimes that's right away. Sometimes it shows up weeks or even months later. And we have been working to develop, again, a regional response to that. You've heard a lot of discussion of interoperable communications, and that has been a big activity as well of this program, making sure that people can talk to each other, even if their usual communication systems go down. Medical surge, which means that in addition to your usual patient load, that you're able to take on a huge influx of patients in a very short period of time. And there have been a number of things that have happened in that area and a lot of planning that's gone on. We have a new system to track beds and resources. How many beds are available at any given time in the state? We have a system that tracks that on a routine basis. We're building into that now how many courses of medication or equipment that might be available and being able to track that regularly. We have a new system called Minnesota Responds, which is related to the worst acronym in history. It is called ESRVIP, which stands for the Emergency System for Advanced Registration of Voluntary Health Professionals. And I would love to have been a little mouse in the corner when they came up with that. But we decided to call it Minnesota Responds. We have currently 6,000 volunteers, healthcare volunteers everywhere, everyone from physicians to nurses to veterinarians to morticians who have signed up and have said, call on me if you have an event and you need assistance. You heard a little bit ago from the League of Minnesota Cities looking at issues of liability and workers' comp. That's an issue as well for physicians, nurses, and others who are either self-employed or are part of the private sector. And we are looking at some approaches and are looking at a legislative approach this year to, again, make them temporary state employees for the purpose of response to remove that barrier that we've heard from volunteers. We are developing supply and equipment stockpiles, including medications, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. And they've also been doing a lot of work on plans for how do you evacuate a hospital? What if there is an increase, a great increase in the number of fatalities? Mobile medical assets, including the metro area effort right now on a mobile emergency department. This is a comparison of alternative care sites, and I think that it's a fascinating look at how far we've come in a century. The slide on the your left is a picture from the 1918 pandemic influenza slide, or influenza time. And the slide on the right is an exercise from 2007 in the Minneapolis Convention Center practicing a medical surge response. And as I point out to people, those are just fancy lawn chairs. Then I'm going to move now to the public health side of preparedness. And this also started in 2002, and the Centers for Disease Control in particular is the one working on this funding, and they folded in a few other activities that had already been in place. But we have received, in this program, $85 million. This year's amount is, again, a reduction from last year. The base activities are about $11.5 million. The city's readiness initiative, which is funding to the city's metropolitan statistical area, the program goal of that initiative is that we are able to provide medications to every resident in the 11-county metro area within 48 hours. We're not quite there yet, but we're working on various plans to make that happen. We also have received pandemic influenza funding. This is the third year of that funding, and this year we received $3 million. It's the last year, they tell us, so we should continue to be working very hard on getting our plans in place. Of the funding that we receive this year, about $7.5 million goes to local health departments and about $230,000 to tribal governments.
Is Light Heiser?
Yes.
I think Senator Limmer has a question.
Sorry, yes, sir.
Hi, Madam or Ms. Director Lighthouse, the 48-hour inoculation that you made reference to, is that with a specific product anticipating just one type of influenza, or what does it include? Is it just the plan to do that in 48 hours, or is that having the inoculation ready, the serum that would be necessary?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the 48 hours is a plan for aerosolized anthrax, and it is oral medications, either ciprofloxacin or doxycycline. And the plan is that we have some of the medication in hand that we would be able to get started on. The Strategic National Stockpile would arrive within 12 hours of our request and would come with the additional materials that we would need. We've been working with the United States Postal Service. Some of the delivery would be through use of postal workers. Some would be drive-through clinics. Some would be mass dispensing clinics. Some we would take to businesses and have them give to their employees. We have a variety of plans, and all of the local jurisdictions have been working very hard. And we've done a number of exercises already. Although I would say we're still probably a ways from being able to do everybody. But it's not an inoculation. It's an oral medication.
And Madam Chair, one last other question. The other question I might have is I noticed all of the budget references that you made and the numbers, some are rather large and some, you know, I'm not quite sure how one would predict the dollar amount in order to anticipate a breakout of something and not knowing what might break out. I would say that that's a rather difficult thing to do, to budget for an unknown. And is this enough money to prepare for most unexpected unknown problems? Or how do we arrive at that, and are we prepared?
Ms. Lighthizer.
Madam Chair, the funding that we receive from the federal government is based on the amount that Congress appropriates, and then they divide it out by population. And we have a reduction in our funding almost every year. So one of the challenges is adjusting our program activities to the grant levels and the grant requirements. And I think as Mr. Gustafson said earlier, usually we're funded to do the preparedness work, but the response funding is something that happens after we're all done. Then we sit down and say, where are we at? We received for the first time for the Southeast Minnesota floods a check from FEMA for some of our activities. We received $16,000, which is the first check we've ever gotten from FEMA, so we're going to frame it. But it is very difficult.
Before or after you cash it?
Take a color copy of it.
Check. It's just a count thing, but still. They don't write a check, right? It is very difficult to know, and part of what we are doing is trying to make sure that people throughout the Minnesota Department of Health and throughout the state at local levels of government are prepared in some way and in some fashion. I talked earlier about the amount of work that's gone on in the healthcare side. That's new efforts that most of them have undertaken that we've not had before. So we're in better shape. It's a continuous challenge to stay trained and to be ready for all of the various things. We started out in 2002 thinking that we needed to be ready for things like anthrax. Then we discovered that, well, we needed to also expand that to include being ready for smallpox, which has very different kinds of issues. Then SARS came along. which is a real event that we needed to be prepared for. And now pandemic influenza is certainly on our radar screen. And lately, there's been a lot of discussion about radiological dirty bomb events and the Republican National Convention. So there's a lot of issues and activities. We have a heightened sense of awareness.
Dr. Ostrom.
Madam Chair, not to preempt Ms. Lighthizer's presentation, but to respond back to Senator Limerich, I think is a very important point, is the health department doesn't actually have control over the healthcare system of the state, nor I'm not sure anyone does necessarily. And part of the problem we have is they can't prepare that. We have a healthcare system today where one person every minute in this country is diverted from the nearest emergency room, despite the fact they're in crisis, because that emergency room in a legal status is so full that if they go to that emergency room, they may be at greater risk of serious harm than if they go further on to another emergency room. Everything today in our healthcare system is a just-in-time delivery system. Most of our hospitals today have no more than 2 days of oxygen on hand. Most of our hospitals today get two-a-day delivery supplies because that's the way it is in the system. We have shortages all the time. Right now, as we speak, there are women all over this United States right this minute that cannot get the necessary radio imaging done for their breast cancer diagnosis today because one of only two reactors in the world that make radioisotopes went down unexpectedly. The healthcare system is in such short supply today and in crisis situation that it's just important to understand that as much as we can prepare for this and plan for it, in the end, they have to execute it. And so when you ask if we're prepared, the health department really can't make that happen, because if they could, we wouldn't be having a discussion today about uninsured citizens or the issues of who's going to get what kind of health care, et cetera. That's, I think, something we just have to recognize. I don't think it's beyond the scope of this commission to be able to address that issue, but at least it's something to know, that I have no great hope that the health care system will respond with any clarity or any comprehensive nature during a crisis. We will be largely on our own.
Madam Chair, it probably goes back to the very reason why we're here. and listening to all of this discussion, and that's to determine, probably, because we don't have a formal definition of what our purpose is on this, but I think we're beginning to realize that there's obvious questions that have to be asked. And the first question that comes to my mind is are we ready for an unexpected or maybe an possible anticipated event? And if the present system during a normal day can barely keep up with just the normal health care crises of our citizens, then we're really not prepared to handle any type of emergency of any size or scope. And so the question comes up then is, how much would it cost? What can we anticipate? And I think we'll be chasing our tail, trying to anticipate. We'll be up all night trying to figure out what's the next disease or airborne pathogen that's going to float over our heads some night while we're sleeping, and we could worry ourselves to death over it all, and we're not going to do that. But at the same time, it's better to approach this thing with eyes wide open rather than get a little sleepy on it.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think Senator Limmer and Dr. Osterholm's points part of the Minnesota response, this network of providers. I'm really glad to hear it. One of the things that I learned in as an aftermath of the bridge collapse was that not only did I live in Lindstrom, represent Chisago County and our Lakes Area EMS. Had three responders who were involved in the bridge response by happenstance and getting themselves down there. But I didn't know that they had acted until a couple of weeks ago, that they had activated every single one of their employees to staff up entirely in anticipation of transfers. And I understand, Mr. Forte, perhaps you could, I'm seeing you nod, so I'm seeing that they were not alone in doing so. And just thinking about if we have a pandemic outbreak where we don't have one incident for a few hours, the same EMS service is currently running at a 25% deficit because of underpayment on Medicare reimbursements. So imagine the taxing on that system if we have all these essentially cabs transferring patients from one intensive care unit to another. Or I mean, I think that it's such a critical piece of that infrastructure and response it's one area where they're already suffering. And I think it's a special case outside of just our straight healthcare delivery system that I'm curious if you have any thoughts about this kind of hidden part of our response and funding issues there. That, I mean, we can have all of our EMS services in the state lose financial viability in 12 hours.
Ms. Lighthizer, can you comment on
that? Madam Chair and members, emergency medical services has been an important partner in our planning and thinking about how do we handle a variety of events similar to what you've just been describing, whether it's an acute event, what we need to move people very quickly. And clearly it worked very well with the bridge collapse. There was a great deal of ability to work together. In a pandemic influenza situation, we're working on how will we transport people and whether they'll be able to be transported by ambulance. One of the mobile medical assets that we're currently working with the metro area on purchasing is a transport vehicle that would be able to transport a larger number of people at a time. But whether during pandemic influenza we're actually transporting people around is one of the questions. And again, will we try to save capacity for the people having heart attacks or trauma incidents or things? It's going to be very difficult, and we don't have all those plans in place. How we sustain emergency medical services is an important resource, and I don't know that I have the answers to that today. But a good question.
Thank you.
Okay, why don't you continue? Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're down there so quiet.
Ms. Lighthizer, I was very impressed with the 48-hour goal that you mentioned, and I suspect that that makes Minnesota one of the states that can respond best when comparing to other states. Is that true? How do you think we do compare in responsiveness to other states? I know people were very impressed with our bridge response, but how about on the public health side? And then also, has the federal government since 9/11 set standards, like said, well, if there's an anthrax incident, you know, be prepared to do this within 48 hours with a pandemic? This, you know, have you gotten any direction in that way?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, the 48-hour goal that I mentioned is actually a federal goal.
Okay.
There's a cities readiness initiative, at least one in every state. And if you have a cities readiness initiative program, then you are all trying to meet that same goal of 48 hours. And actually, the 48 hours is a standard that we are working toward as a whole state, not just for the cities area. There are some standards. There's a lot of work being done on that right now. There's a lot of people who would say the standards that we've had so far are not fully descriptive of our preparedness levels. And as been talked about, it's difficult. What do you measure? Do you measure how many people have been trained? Do you measure how quickly people can respond? Do you measure how many people can get information when it's sent out? There's a challenge in what are our benchmarks and what are our outcome measures. We have some. I would say Minnesota, as is true in many of our program areas, feel that we have a lot of things in place. And a lot of that is our state-local partnership, and that there's a lot of work that's been done already, and we have a foundation to build on. Some states are starting much further back than we did. We also know that it takes work to keep going and to keep things in place.
Thank you.
All right.
I mentioned the state-local partnership, and you've had this slide in front of you. We have 53 local boards of health. They are broken out into 8 regions, which are the same as our healthcare regions, and that includes 87 counties and 4 cities, some of them multi-county or multi-city. Some of the highlights are our Health Alert Network. Many of you have heard about that tool, which is a way for us to reach people quickly across the state in multiple ways. We have, while we've talked about some of our particular responses depending on the event, we do work from an all-hazards approach, that regardless of the hazard, there are a variety of things that we would need to do. Education and exercises, I mentioned the Strategic National Stockpile, some of our coordination and collaboration activities. I just want to point out that while I'm going to be talking about some of our emergency preparedness activities, that this is connected to some of our ongoing work. And as was mentioned earlier, a lot of our ability to respond is built into our other activities of infectious disease, laboratory analysis, environmental exposures. And most events have some sort of a human health component. You have some pictures of some of the things that have happened. The just-in-time training is just before the hepatitis A clinic, which is then carried out below in the mass clinic. They did 2,000 injections of immunoglobulin to people who were exposed to hepatitis A. The picture of the specialized laboratory, we have a biosafety level 3 laboratory in the building down the street that is able to analyze some pretty specialized and scary things. And because I'm from public health and I can't help it, we encourage you to wash your hands. Local Health Department grant duties, as I mentioned, they get not quite half of the funding from the local, from the public health side. And they are asked to do some specific activities of planning, training, and exercises. And they are asked to work with us on a variety of exercises for continuity of operations or mass vaccination or communication things. We have some tools that we use for preparedness and response. I don't know if you can see it very well. The picture up, the boxes of multiple things, that is one set of strategic national stockpile materials that would be sent to us. We have plans for where that material will be sent, breaking it down into smaller pieces, truck routes for, and alternate truck routes for where we would send things, security for those materials and resources, and a variety of plans for how those materials would be used. And you also were told about Code Ready, which is codeready.org, which would take you to a site that is was developed in Minnesota that talks about various disasters and bad things and helps you develop a plan for yourself and your family. Then I want to talk just a little bit about pandemic influenza and then stand for questions. We use the sort of three-level approach. An emergency is you need to respond quickly, and you can manage it within your own resources. Disaster, again, you need to respond quickly, and you need help from others, and you will get help. It's available. And a catastrophe, you need help from others, but no help is available. And I would argue that pandemic influenza, if it plays out as it might, is a catastrophe. I'm not going to go into detail on this, but this is a slide of some of the challenges that we're dealing with. The disease attack rate is estimated to be about 30%, which means in Minnesota about 1.5 million people would be sick. 172,000 people would look to the hospital for hospital-level care. We currently have about 16,000 hospital beds available in Minnesota. That means we'd be short about 85,000. And some of that would be covered through some of those lawn chairs that I showed you earlier, which I don't think are going to be very comfortable. But our expectation is that a lot of people would be cared for at home by their family, by their friends, by their neighbors. And how do we help that happen? And then there's a variety of other things, including estimates of the deaths. And there's a mass fatality planning that's occurring throughout the state on how would we manage the increased number of deaths. Basically, we would have a year's worth of deaths in 2 months. Pandemic influenza, as I mentioned, we've had 3 years of federal funding and a variety of benchmarks and activities to work on. At the state level, we've had funding in fiscal year 2007 and then again in 2008 and 2009. Last year was $5 million. We purchased some antiviral medications. The federal government has made antiviral medications, you maybe have heard of Tamiflu or Relenza, available at a much reduced price, and have asked that we purchase enough for 10% of the population. We're working toward that. We don't have all of the funds to purchase the whole amount. We've also purchased some ventilators. We've done training and staff. I mentioned the Code Ready campaign. And then funding to local emergency management and other state agency preparedness. This current fiscal year, we have $115,000 for epidemiology, laboratory services, exercise, and planning, and then $3.9 million to purchase antiviral medications and a stockpile of healthcare supplies, and we're currently in the midst of doing that. And then in the out years, there's an appropriation of $100,000 a year starting in 2010. couple of issues and themes. Continuity of operations planning is one thing to manage if you think your building's not going to be available. It's another to work on when you don't have the staff. And that's an issue that all of us in state government are working on. It's an issue at the health department. I mentioned the workforce and volunteers and the needs that we have in that area. Training is a big issue. You've heard about certified emergency management training. There's a number of training issues for public health, and we've been working particularly with the University of Minnesota on that. Relationships you've heard about and how important they are. Exercises and evaluation and performance measurement, which has been brought up, is something that we need to continually have in front of us. And, Madam Chair, if there are any questions.
Thank you very much. You, too, packed a whole lot of information into a very short time. Questions? Representative Lane.
The amount of money you have to purchase antiviral medications for 08-09, just before that you said that you are seeking to try to get up to 10% of the population. How far does that get you towards that?
Good question.
Madam Chair, Representative, our estimate is that to get to the 10%, which is what the current federal government recommendation is, which would, with the amount that the feds have set aside for us, get us to 25% of the population for treatment. This would not be preventive therapy, but for treatment. Our estimate was that it would be about $8 million total to purchase the amount that was available. It has a 5-year shelf life, which is something that we're anxiously hoping that there will be some additional work on. We have, we believe that we would be getting about 60% of the amount that we'd be able to purchase. We're waiting to see if there's an additional extension of the contract so that there'll be additional opportunities to purchase in the future. Right now, the contract ends the end of this month.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, one more question. Just a further comment. You guys got me worried. Your comments, Dr. Osterholm, and I'm probably on this because of my worry about the pandemic flu and that we were not funding it. Catastrophe. Need to respond quickly, need help from others, but no help is available. Pandemic flu falls here. The whole scenario, healthcare, 2 days supply in the healthcare system. What else, besides direct involvement to the flu, what else do we need to be looking at to prevent societal breakdown as people go into fear and concern and those trucks coming in with the Tamiflu are hijacked, the postal worker who's supposed to deliver it isn't showing up, he's back home with his family or he's sick or he's dead, you know, you go on and on with this and there's more than even the healthcare part. If there's a major catastrophe and people need to be just working with one another, how do we actually have a kind of societal coming together and in disaster still hope, still some kind of base so that it doesn't turn into breakdown? How do we approach that?
Ms. Lighthizer.
Madam Chair, Representative, those are excellent questions. I think some of our work is to continually be training and preparing and having people be comfortable in knowing what they are capable of doing. If we walk into a pandemic without having done any preparedness, people are not going to be able to respond very well. But if we've done some training, we've done exercises, people have the tools that they need, I'm not going to talk to the greater society. I think Director Idy will be doing some talking about that. But our goal is to work with the healthcare system. What is it that a healthcare worker needs to feel comfortable coming to work? What's it going to take? What's the level of personal protective equipment? Are they saying that if they don't have the antivirals or the vaccine that they won't come to work? What are our options in that framework? And we have many, many people in Minnesota and I think throughout the country that will put themselves at great risk. But they want to know that there's some work being done by the government or their employer as well, and that's part of our job is to continually be talking about that. We have a number of work groups. We also have a work group right now on the ethical issues of pandemic influenza. We're not going to have enough stuff. So who should get it? How should those decisions get made? If there's not enough ventilators, who gets them? And there's a group that will be going out and soliciting input from community groups about that. We also have a science advisory team that's working at how do we stretch oxygen? How do we stretch pain medications? What are some ways that we might have to do some of that? That helps us somewhat. It doesn't solve all of the problems, but we are starting to think about how do we do that to the best we can.
Mr. Andrews.
Thank you, Chairman. I think one of the things we've talked about as a group is to try and, as a group, identify the spectrum of potential events or threats that are relevant to our work to assess the likelihood that any specific event might happen and also the consequences if they do, and to look at our existing capabilities across the board to deal with this spectrum of events and see if there are gaps and how they might be filled. In your area, my guess is this is something you do on a daily basis, look at potential events, look at potential consequences, look at where your gaps are, and think about how you might fill those gaps. And I think we could spend a lot of time with you today talking about this, and I understand we've got a firm 5 o'clock deadline, I think, tonight. So I'm just going to ask you one question. As you look at this three-category matrix that you set up, emergencies, disasters, and catastrophes, and think about the events that are within your spectrum of responsibility. The day after we have an emergency, disaster, or catastrophe in one of these areas, what is the one thing, or maybe to be fair, discrete list of things that you would say you would have wished we would have done before it? And then the follow-on question is, why aren't we doing it now?
Ms. Lighthouse.
Madam Chair, Mr. Andreasen, you guys have great questions. I would say following an event, if I had to pick one thing, it would probably, I'm going to cheat and have be two related things. I would say it's clarity of roles and responsibilities and training in those areas. And why we don't have that now, I think it's time. I think it's understanding what an event needs. We learned a lot from particularly the Southeast Minnesota floods about what is needed, how do you get it there, how do you describe it. Sometimes we've not been faced with a particular situation before. The bridge collapse is something we've not done before, but there was a lot of great response to that, and Chief Forte has talked about the roles and responsibilities, the relationships, and the training, and clarity about that is one of the reasons that went so well. I think we're still in health. We're newer to that arena, and we don't have all of those things fully figured out yet.
Thank you.
Dr. Ostrom.
Madam Chair, can I just ask for clarification? Given we have many other important witnesses here who are going to provide us with great information, we have a 5 o'clock deadline. I don't want to preempt this, but I assume, have you made a decision yet whether we're going to ask them to come back to the next meeting, or are we going to try to squeeze them in the next 10 minutes?
Well, we were just talking about that, actually. And I think what we'll do is have Ms. Clark and Mr. Wiggins come back. I'm sorry. You've sat here patiently all day. And spend the rest of the time with Ms. Idy and Representative Winkler so we can maybe go to 5:15 without getting him into a real pickle.
You're not supposed to say that.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Okay. So that would give us almost a half hour with Ms. Idy, and I think.
Could I just invite it? Let me just a brief comment. I mean, I think that it's very important for this group to understand that what Ms. Lighthizer was just talking about, pandemic influenza, is definitely going to happen. It's not a question of if. It's just a matter of when, where, and how it starts. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important distinction. Like earthquakes, hurricanes, and tsunamis, pandemics happen. They've been 300 of them. you know, over history, 10 in the last 300 years, and we're going to have more of them. So I hope that, unlike a lot of things, whether it'll be another terrorism event, we don't know. Whether there'll be other bridge collapses, we don't know. Whether there'll be other things like that, but there will be another pandemic. And I think that's an important consideration as we look at this issue. And I think the second part of it is that and we asked some of the questions here, is that one of the areas that has been woefully underrepresented and, frankly, absent at the table in many of these discussions has been the business community. And as a public health person, that may sound odd that I'm talking about the business community, but today in this global just-in-time economy, all your medications, for example, I don't know how many of you are, 85% of all the pharmaceutical drugs we use in this country come from offshore today. They're manufactured outside the United States with very long, thin supply chains. And so I worry about how many people are going to die from diabetes not getting their insulin during a pandemic because they won't have insulin as opposed to people who die from flu. And they can go through a whole laundry list of these kinds of issues that I think we have to engage that part, too, because during so many of the other crises we deal with, where it's bridge collapses or southeastern Minnesota, there is enough reserve capacity for that limited hit over a limited time that we never see that part of the crisis, and therefore we just don't deal with it. But when everybody's in the soup at the same time, every village, town, county, state, country, we are going to have that happen, and we will stop international trade and travel. And I think Minnesota's going to have to plan for that part of it. And given that this is an inevitable event, whether it's a very severe one, a moderate one, or a mild one, I think we have to plan for that. So I would hope that we pay particular attention to this one because I think this one, being that it is inevitable and being that it is going to be catastrophic, that we will all be held accountable if we haven't done more to prepare for this one when we had every knowledge that it was going to happen.
Dr. Rostrom, I have a question. We've always talked in terms of the pandemic being a flu. Is there any likelihood that it'll be a different disease instead of a flu that will shut us down?
Madam Chair, influenza is the only illness like this. I mean, we could have anthrax and smallpox and SARS and all kinds of things like this, but from a whole lot of reasons worth a lot more discussion, influenza is the only one that we really worry about, and it will spread quickly, and it will move around the world, and it will involve all of us, and it will take months, which is something from a fatigue factor standpoint. At the time that the SARS epidemic unfolded around the world, I was one of the acting directors at the CDC at the time, and I spent time in Toronto at those hospitals, and I watched healthcare workers leave the hospital and not come to work because they didn't feel safe, even though they had adequate masks, respirators, et cetera. During a pandemic, we'll run out of respirators in the first weeks. The worldwide capacity to make respirators is so thin, most of them are made outside of the United States, we won't have them overnight. Will we get health workers to come to work, or anyone else for that matter, when we don't have that? So that's what makes pandemic influenza so different, and it is the one that clearly any of us that are worried. And if you've been following the news media the last 72 hours, our interest and our concern has only been piqued. But if you know what's going on right now in Pakistan and in areas like that, it's not a good situation.
Just a quick comment. I just want to say that when we were discussing funding for the pandemic and the committee responsible, it was only the two of us that were a little older that had any concern at all. It was really laughed at by those who have never even had any connection whatsoever to 1918, which I only have from my father being born at that time and the stories around that. It is not even understood at the leadership level.
I know when it was a budget item in my budget, I kind of blew it off, I have to admit, because I didn't have enough money and had other things that, you know.
Madam Chair, just to give you an idea of this, just in, because I think, again, Chris, this will actually reflect back in some of your issues of preparedness. I just gave a talk recently with the CEO of one of the largest electrical generating companies in the United States. His area covers a very important part of the United States. And 30 years ago, he had about 90 days of coal on hand. 15 years ago, he was down to 30 days. Now he has less than 20 days of coal on hand because of a whole lot of tax issues, because of just-in-time delivery issues, because of environmental issues, because there's a railroad that he wants to run through Rochester that won't let his train run through, et cetera, which I'm not trying to comment on that. And he happens to be a long distance from here, but we actually play a role in that. He has made it very clear to the leadership of that large geographic area of the United States that he has no hope to keeping the lights on during a pandemic, during a situation where they will not be able to move coal because they will run out within 20 days. And he does not believe he will get the coal that he needs for his major organization to keep the lights on. Now, when you start looking at the one-offs, the two-offs, the three-offs, the four-offs, the five-offs, of what that means, you begin to understand the implications for this. If you look at the food supply today, if you look at any number of things like this, it is built on a house of cards in the global just-in-time economy. And I think that's the kind of thing that is so different than from anything we've ever talked about or will talk about, and that, I think, is the concern that all of us have.
On that cheery note, Ms. Ide.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Ide, and I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, which is a division of the Department of Public Safety. And I'm very happy to be with you today to really give you kind of an overview of preparedness funding in the state of Minnesota. And just to put it into perspective, I have here our vision and mission for Homeland Security and Emergency Management, which we call HSEM. Our vision is really keeping Minnesota ready, and the mission is to help Minnesota prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and human-caused disasters. And the theme of the last few weeks has been maintaining the partnerships, and we certainly agree with that. We collect and we share information, we plan, train, educate, and then we coordinate the response and the resources and provide financial, technical assistance for state agencies and local units of government, as you have heard. Our enabling legislation is Minnesota Statutes Chapter 12. That is where Mr. Freed was talking about the requirement of all counties and cities to have an emergency management director appointed. We in the Department of Public Safety coordinate the state agency response and the preparedness to all hazards. As the director of HSEM, I serve as governor's authorized representative in disaster and the state coordinating officer with FEMA for those declared disasters. We provide assistance and policy for state agencies and local governments, including the training policy that you discussed last week of the requirement of emergency management directors in the counties and the cities to become certified within 48 months of their appointment. We also maintain and update on a regular basis annually the emergency operations plan, which is all hazards. This also includes a response to both the nuclear power plants we have in within the borders of Minnesota and also the influenza pandemic emergency operations plan. Foreign animal diseases are also in here. It goes into everything from donations management to alert and warning, incident management, and those kinds of things. We're also responsible to update the governor's executive order assigning responsibility to state agencies. That number executive order is 07-14. Here's a little bit of preparedness profile on us. We administer both Homeland Security and Emergency Management programs within the state of Minnesota. We are only one of nine states that have combined Homeland Security and Emergency Management. The profile is very different depending on your state. I report to the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, which is about 30% of Emergency Management directors are in the Department of Public Safety. It's a growing number that our direct reports to the governors of every state. Some of them are from anything from the Department of Administration to Military Affairs. There are quite a few adjutants general that serve as the emergency management and or the Homeland Security Advisor. We are divided into six Homeland Security Emergency Management regions. You heard Ms. Lighthizer talk about their eight regions. We in HSEM are divided into six regions. It was changed to six regions about 15, 20 years ago, and that was also based on budget cuts at that time. It does have its challenges of crossing borders between health and Homeland Security. It also has its challenges that can't be overcome with law enforcement districts, with fire districts. We facilitate the Senior Advisory Committee and its 23 work groups. The Senior Advisory Committee is a requirement by the federal government for Homeland Security departments that covers a broad spectrum of the 10 disciplines that make up Homeland Security. In our case, it's co-chaired by the Commissioners of Public Safety and Health, and it includes members from associations of county governments, city governments, fire, hazmat, law enforcement, public works, the whole spectrum of the 10 different disciplines. And we have 23 work groups within that senior advisory committee, all with members from the committee and members from outside the committee that work on the grant applications and work dealing with different issues in the realm of Homeland Security. These are the programs in Homeland Security. And when a lot of people think of the Department of Homeland Security, they think of the federal department dealing with border issues, dealing with immigration, real ID. These are the grant programs that we have to meet preparedness, response, and recovery requirements to receive the money. It's the State Homeland Security Grant Program, Law Enforcement Terrorism Prevention, the Urban Area Security Initiative, Buffer Zone Protection, Transit Security, Port Security, Citizen Corps, which is Citizen Preparedness, Metropolitan Medical Response System, Assistance to Firefighter Grants, and Commercial Equipment Direct Assistance. They all have their own requirements, and they all have their own reporting. Some of the items that we funded with Homeland Security over the past few years have been local responder equipment. And in a little bit, I'll talk about how the funding for Homeland Security has been changing over the last few years. You also heard Ms. Rollwagon talk about the collapsed rescue teams, the hazmat, the bomb squads. That's all part of the statewide response teams that in part are funded from both the law enforcement prevention and state Homeland Security grants. The Minnesota Joint Analysis Center, you've heard about fusion centers, which is the fusion of information, intelligence analysis among the different disciplines and between the federal government, the local government, private industry, and state government. We call it the MINJAC in Minnesota. We provide the funding for that, and that is all federal funding, no state funding for that. A large project that we funded in 2004, I believe, is the Automated Fingerprint Identification System, the AFIS system, through the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. That was partially funded through Homeland Security grant funds. And we provide regional grants. Because of the way the funding has been happening over the last few years, we have found not only was it imperative that we streamline the spending, but it also makes operational sense that because we can't afford every county to be prepared to the same level with the same things, that we do it on a regional basis. So we provide a grant to each of our 6 Homeland Security and Emergency Management regions. They have created either a joint powers entity or they have created some kind of a mutual aid pact for spending of this money. They have a fiscal agent that they have assigned, and that person is the administrator of that grant. It must be agreed upon by the members of that region on what the priorities are for their region and how they are going to be spending their grants. Most of the 2007 money will be used for interoperable communications. So we're leveraging the money from the from a Department of Commerce grant, also $14.62 million from the Department of Commerce, which Mr. Wiggins will talk to you about next week, and the armor system funding with this grant funding. We've also funded some projects for evacuation planning, and I know there were questions last week about evacuation planning. The Department of Transportation was the lead agency on the transportation management side of an evacuation planning. Also, the Department of Agriculture has been given some emergency response funding for a multi-state partnership to work with geographic information systems on identifying agriculture resources and also to provide for a response. We've improved the infrastructure of the transit system in this state with video surveillance and monitoring at Metro Transit stations so that we can improve the security on those. Also, we've gotten quite a few millions of dollars for port security. We have 4 ports in the state and that are eligible for this funding, and we've received about $6 million over the past 2 years for port security. Some items that we fund through the emergency management, and you heard Mr. Freed talk about the Emergency Management Performance Grant, and that's really what this is. Through that is our all hazards planning. It is our only funding stream for all hazards planning, and it is spent on state and local operations for preparedness, response, recovery, and mitigation to provide the funding for our training section and all the exercising that goes along with that comes out of our EMPG funds. Some of the programs we have on the emergency management side of our house is, as I mentioned, the EMPG all hazards funding. We have hazardous materials program, which includes the chemical assessment teams, the emergency response team, our staff that are technical assistants to local units of government, and the planning that we do with the individual facilities to ensure that that communities that we can administer the Community Right to Know Act. Radiological emergency preparedness has been growing, specifically even growing since this past year with the requirement now of security exercises. But we work with used to be Northern States Power, and then XL, and then Nuclear Management Company, and now again Northern States Power on their two nuclear power plants within the state. And we have a special assessment for that planning that's done. And we pass through that grant funds to state agencies and to local units of government. And if you'll excuse me, I'll put my cough drop back in my mouth. Ms. Lighthizer was talking about, we do pandemic influenza. Last year, we received $2.9 million from the Department of Health, which we passed through the majority of that to local units of government, to state agencies. And this year, we received $75,000 to keep one of our FTEs in Homeland Security to make sure that we can continue some of that activity. And we also have created the School Safety Center within the Department of Public Safety, HSEM, with interagency grants from the Office of Justice Programs within Public Safety, burn grant money, and also from the Minnesota Department of Education. It's an important issue to us, and we didn't receive any general fund, but we decided that we really needed to do it anyway, and we found the funding to do that. So here's some of the funding mechanisms that we deal with. And I understand that it is very difficult to track preparedness funding. I have 85 allotment orgs, and I'm a very small division. So some of those allotment orgs are preparedness. Some of them are a combination of preparedness and response. Some of them are federal. Some of them cross the federal fiscal year. Some of them cross multiple state and federal fiscal years. So I know how difficult it is to track really what is preparedness funding. But we receive funding in many different ways. We receive formula funds. Our EMPG fund is formula. Portion of our state hazard mitigation fund is formula. It also has a competitive side to it. So the portion of our Homeland Security grant funds that aren't formula driven are all competitive. There are also preparedness funds. I mentioned earlier the assistance to firefight grants and the commercial equipment grants. Those are direct funds from the federal government to counties or cities and do not pass through HSEM. But the majority of the federal funds that go to cities and to counties and to other state agencies do go through HSEM. From the state, we have general fund money. We have special revenue, as I talked about, with the nuclear power plants, and we have interagency agreements with the School Safety Center and with the pandemic flu grant. Here's our funding sources. 70% of emergency management funding for HSEM comes through the federal government. 23% comes from state appropriations, and 7% comes from the other, which is the special revenue.
Ms. Idy, I think Representative Kalin has a question.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Idy, I hesitate to slow the train down as we're getting close to 5:15. I want to give you a break to work on your lozenge. I'm trying to understand a little bit the relationship of your office at DPS to other state agencies and their offices of emergency management, emergency preparedness. And the one, of course, I'm most familiar with is the situation at MnDOT, where the position description, I believe, was originally described up to $5.4 million annual budget, I believe, and that the realization is now less than, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of $500,000. Can you describe a little bit, maybe using this as the example of how that money comes either through your office to MnDOT or other agencies or directly to?
Yes, okay. Madam Chair, Representative Kalin. A portion of that money comes through the Homeland Security Grant Program. And that changed, the way in which we need to apply changed in 2006. So we got a boatload of money in 2003, 2004, and 2005. And agencies and local units of government applied to HSEM at that point, and we identified how they were going to use the money and then put it through to them. So a portion of MnDOT's money, portion of the agriculture's money, you heard earlier from Human Services, that was money, one-time project money, that would go to them. Most of the state agencies don't have an actual Office of Emergency Preparedness as Health and MnDOT have. So a lot of the money that they get really is one-time money and not money for their office operations. But it's really based on a project, because now the way that we have to give out the money is pre-identified projects. Then we actually apply to the federal government for those particular pre-identified projects.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair. So the current budget for, let's say, for MnDOT's office and other agencies that have their own offices or have dedicated staff, maybe that aren't within a specific office or department, that's internal allocation now, not from their own department budget, not from the DPS HSEM budget.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, that is correct.
And that's been that situation since that change in 2006. So the 07 fiscal year and beyond, or the 06 fiscal year.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, that's really up to the individual department how they're funding their Office of Emergency Preparedness. However, in order to get money from us, it has to be tied to a project.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. So does any of the money pay for salaries that comes from the federal government?
Madam Chair, only 15% of the money that comes from the federal government can be used for personnel costs.
Okay.
And that's overall. So that's not even of each one. It's overall of the whole grant, only 15% for personnel.
And you track that in your office?
We do.
Okay. All right. Proceed, please.
Okay. Thank you. The national average across the country is 60% of most emergency management offices comes from the federal and 40% of state appropriations. So here's a little bit of the federal funding history. I talked about a boatload of money. $67 million to me is a boatload of money. So in 2004, we got $67 million plus. 2005, we got just about $50 million. 2006, we got $16.5 million. That includes the assistance to firefighting grants and the commercial equipment. So actually what we in HSEM got to keep and pass through was only about $13 million. And then in 2007, what we get to allocate is $20.5 million. EMPG funding for our all hazards preparedness in 2005 was $3,086,000. 2006, $3,154,000, and in 2007, we received $3.4 million. From the state general fund, We received $2.545 million for our emergency management performance grant. That's the fund that and the program that covers not only our preparedness but also some mitigation operations, some recovery operations, and some response operations. So you see, it can be difficult to really focus on preparedness. For 2008 and 9, we received $75,000 appropriation for our pan flu preparedness. Radiological emergency preparedness, the special assessment, is a little over $2 million. And then the school safety center, we received $443,800 through interagency grants to start up that program. So how do we compare across the country? We're being asked this a lot. And as a state director, I'm a member of the National Emergency Management Association, and we do a biennial survey every 2 years. And we report on a lot of things, including our structure and our funding. We're considered a medium state. A medium state is 4 million to 10 million. The average overall emergency management staff is 76 FTEs. We have 64.9 Homeland Security and Emergency Management FTEs. So this runs anywhere from a three-person staff in Vermont to a 231-person staff in California, and that's just their Homeland Security. Then they have emergency management on top of that. So we feel that we've been able to leverage a lot of hard work with those funds. The EMPG national average. So overall, state and federal emergency management is 76, but those funded under EMPG funds averages 34 FTEs, and Minnesota funds 25 FTEs out of our EMPG fund. The state appropriation average is $4 million, and as I told you, ours is approximately $2.5 million. We spend 51 cents per capita on emergency preparedness, and the national average is 73 cents. Also, there is no requirement, no federal requirement of a state to pass through EMPG. 96% of the states do pass through EMPG funds to their local units of government at an average of 46%. So they pass 46%. In our case, the $3.4 million, we pass through 51% of that to our local units of government. And as you heard from Chief Butler and Mr. Freed, it is woefully inadequate for their gaps that they have found.
A question from Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Idiot, comparing to other states, is it a little bit like apples to oranges, a little bit difficult just because structures are so different? And, you know, for instance, you know, you have 6 employees at this state agency, are they counted, and 2 at this one, and or is this actually represented on apples to apples?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, the 64.9 and the 76, that is only HSEM staff. That's not other state agency staff.
And
So it is apples to apples.
Quick follow-up, other states might have all of their for instance, have all of, somebody who is a liaison to transportation, liaison to ag in their own, in their HSEM central office and not dispersed within agencies.
Madam Chair, Representative, that could be.
Okay.
Okay. Now, the Homeland Security requirements for that funding, we receive a base allocation. So last year, the Congress appropriates an amount of money for all the different programs in the Department of Homeland Security. And of that total allocation, every state got 0.75% of the total pot. This year, the recommendation is 0.25% of the total pot. So you can see already that if 08 gets passed the way it's intended to be passed, that we will only get a third of the base amount that we get. So you take that base amount, and everything over above that is competitive, which they call investment justifications, which is basically a business case on why we need the money. So what we do is there's all these requirements that are called target capabilities. So every state's supposed to have a capability regardless of your size, a capability to respond to 15 scenarios, which are all in the realm of a catastrophic event. Then of those 15 scenarios, there are 36 target capabilities that we're supposed to target our activities to. We find out we're supposed to assess where we land in those target capabilities, and that money is to be used to fund projects to move us toward the capabilities. The stipulation is that 80% of that money must be passed through to the locals. So the state agencies can only keep 20% of that. And some of the projects that are of high priority are very staff intensive. And a good example of that is the MNJAC, that we have a lot of good relationships with local government, with Homeland Security, with the FBI, with the Secret Service, and with the Homeland Security and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and Sheriff's Departments in the Fusion Center. That's all people. We don't have a lot of toys there. So it's all people, but a cap of 15% for all personnel is what we have to do. That's local personnel. That state personnel can only be that 15% that we can spend out of that money. For EMPG is formula funding, and it's a 50-50 match, and then we have to meet the program requirements. So we have to develop a work plan. We have to make sure that we meet the requirements that we say in our plan we're going to meet, that we've identified in target capabilities. Because, again, it's also very difficult sometimes to decouple the Homeland Security requirements from emergency management, because we consider Homeland Security really as a part of emergency management. Because, you know, regardless of what the nexus of a catastrophe is, we still need the same types of response. So it's really difficult sometimes to separate those two. But there is a 50-50 match. And you heard Mr. Freed talk earlier that the locals overmatch at about 70-30. And that's with a 10% emergency management director in some counties and a 25% emergency management directors in other counties. Federally, EMPG is historically underfunded. Until 2005, you saw in 2004 what our appropriation was. That's what we received for 10 years in a row. So there was no increase in EMPG for 10 years. And you also heard Chief Butler talk about that the cities used to be funded with EMPG pass-through. That was absolutely impossible to do with having the requirements for the oversight that we in public safety had, and to continue to pass through to the counties the amount of money that we needed to pass through to them. So we could no longer directly fund the cities of the first class or the University of Minnesota, and we cannot entertain new EMPG grantees such as the tribal governments. We've been asked, and we've had to turn them down because we cannot accept any more grantees on the EMPG funding string. In a survey that AMEM did that you heard from Mr. Freed, the status of some of the other the emergency management directors, if we were actually to match 50% of the locals and they weren't overmatching, that alone would take an additional $2 million of EMPG, and I don't see us getting $2 million extra dollars from the federal government for that funding string. And I said earlier that EMPG funding really is used to cover a lot of those non-eligible Homeland Security activities, because Homeland Security has very stringent requirements on what these things can and can't be used for. And if there are things that they can't be used for, such as rent for our staff, then we use EMPG to cover a lot of those things. Here's some of our challenges. I already talked about the preparedness really is staff intensive. And Mr. Freed said that emergency management is kind of a mystery. So when you have a plan, your plan is not written and it sits on the shelf. Your plan is reviewed every year. On the local level, the plan is reviewed by a different body every year. So 1 year is the county board, one year it's peers, 1 year it's our staff that reviews it, and I forget who it is the fourth year, but there are four different entities that review a local plan. You train, you exercise, you change your plan. So it doesn't sit on the shelf, because there's nothing more useless than a plan that sits on the shelf. A huge challenge that we see for catastrophic incidents particularly is the special needs populations. That includes elderly, that includes nursing homes, that includes hospitals, that includes people with physical disabilities, people with learning and mental disabilities. And that is really fairly untapped across the country. And that needs a lot of attention over the next few years, because we need to evacuate and shelter those people also, but we have to make sure that we can take care of their special needs. The Minnesota Council on Disabilities has been working wonderfully with us, but they have one person who does about six jobs. They're a very small staff, and one person is doing not only emergency management, but access issues and those kinds of things. For response assets, you heard Ms. Finn talk about liability and workers' comp. That's a huge issue with mutual aid and with a lot of these statewide response assets. If we use private ambulances in our plans and they do they go across their jurisdiction, workers' comp liability is a huge issue, and it's a huge workers' comp huge workers' comp price for that. Also for the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, it's a state-to-state agreement, but most states don't have response assets, so we have intergovernmental agreements with local units of government when they go, but they still are required to carry their own workers' comp, even though they're going to another state's disaster. Facilities and technology is going to continue to be a challenge. You've talked about EOCs. Also, we've talked about geographic information systems and how that is going to also be helping with response. There's a lot of things that we can use GIS for planning and for training and for actual response, but that's also one of those issues, really, that there's people at the state level government in the Land Management Information Center that do that, but emergency management is kind of a tack on also of their salary. Resource management is huge. We're working on that through some shared databases. We still need some more work on that. And warning is also going to be an issue coming down the pike. We continue to need to know how to warn and keep up with technology on warning. And another huge challenge is the unknown. We always plan for the last disaster. We plan for the priorities that have been set out by the federal government, but there's always going to be some unknown, and we always feel like we are going to be behind the power curve on that. And with that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Questions? A lot of information in there as well. Thank you. Members, as usual, we've packed a lot of information into today's work, and I thank you all for being so attentive. Our next meeting will be January 7th here in this room, and let's start at 2:30. That would be all right. And we will pick up Ms. Clark's and Mr. Wiggins' presentations from today. Is that right? Okay. And whatever else. Oh, okay. And then we'll also be meeting on January 21st. Oh, no. January 21st is Martin Luther King weekend. So we will not be meeting on January 21st, and we will, our staff will try and contact you to find a date that will substitute for that day. Anything else? If not, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.